Hey everyone, I think Brian Herbert must have heard all the good things Nate's been saying about him, because we got an all-exclusive first access pass to the Dune movie. That's right, Nate and I are the first two people outside of the cast and crew to have witnessed the entire Dune feature film, directed by David Lynch and starring that guy who's in all the David Lynch projects. So, Nate, what did you think?
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Brian Herbert. This means a lot to me that you're willing to extend this olive branch. I'm just so glad that you not only listen to our podcast and love it, but you gave us this first sneak peek at the new Dune movie by David Lynch. And I gotta say, it was definitely 2 hours and 15 minutes, man.
That's right. I'm just going to drop the bit because I don't have the energy anymore. We literally just watched the 1984 Dune movie by David Lynch because we wanted to watch the new Dune movie. Since we spent so much time on Dune this year, we wanted to like sort of compare it and thought that would be a fun little thing. But coronavirus has fucked us yet again, and we were forced to just go back and watch what was available to us, which was David Lynch's take on the Dune universe. There will be, for anybody who's interested, we actually watched it together and recorded our commentary, so we're going to be releasing a riff tracks for it on YouTube. I'll post something on Twitter and the blog when that's ready. But in the meantime, we're going to do an episode just sort of discussing our thoughts and feelings on this adaptation of one of my favorite books. I kind of want you to start talking about it, Nate, because this is my third time seeing the movie, but this is your first time.
Yeah. Oh, man. So, yeah, it's 2 hours and 15 minutes. Oh, man, it's just a mind-numbing experience for like an hour and 50 minutes. And then it just sprints really quickly towards the conclusion. But they got Fade Rotha's characterization spot on. He was just as big of a player in this movie as he was in the book. Not so sure about Eric Foreman-looking Paul.
I always forget that guy's name.
He's a lot older than a 15-year-old, and his hot mom is only 3 years older than he is.
I think she's 6 years older than he is.
Oh, my bad. Well, someone spits on her face in this movie. The Baron just spits.
Living out Nate's fantasy.
On her face. It's fucking weird. Why did he do that?
Yeah, I guess we should start at the beginning.
Oh, God. What even happened at the beginning? That was like 7 years ago, I feel like.
The book, as we all know, starts with Paul being observed by Jessica and the Reverend Mother, Gaius Helen Mohiam. And they're talking about how special he is and how he's the one. And we get sort of the setup of the book that Paul's our main character. Paul is prophesied to be some big deal. And we kind of go from there. And we get a little bit of establishment that this is a future world, there's different planets, there's space travel, all that junk.
Do we get that from the movie? Like
in the movie, the movie begins instead with a mysterious blonde woman who I, having read the books, recognized as Princess Irulan. But I don't know if the audience would have known who she was had they not read the book. She kind of fades in over a starry background and gives you a brief explanation.
She fades in and out and then in again a few times.
And then out again. Yeah, yeah. So Princess Irulan comes on to explain the setting. And then the Spacing Guild comes in to explain to the Emperor that Paul is this chosen one prophecy guy who's going to fuck up all their evil plans. And then I feel like there's a third layer of exposition
There are multiple layers of exposition.
Where we Paul, finally get to...
Paul is looking at his digital books, telling him
yes,
things.
Yes, yes, yes. So I think it takes... It's about 30 minutes into the movie where the movie actually gets to the point where the book starts.
Yeah. Yep. It's mind-numbing. It's fucking awful. I remember saying at like the hour and a half mark or so, maybe it's like an hour of 10 where the Duke is getting killed. I was like, oh, that happened quick. And you're like, it's over an hour into the movie, dude.
And yeah, no, you kept saying, you're like, well, because all the action is rushed.
Yeah, it's, well, what it is my brain just got numb and just time stopped being a concept, and I just kind of fade away, and then some stuff starts happening and I start paying attention and going, oh, wow, here we go. Something interesting's happening. They got to this part of the book pretty quickly by cutting all that shit out. But they didn't. It was not quick at all.
No. It's a dense book. I mean, the biggest challenge to adapting Dune, and we really wanted to do the 2020 movie because I feel like they're going to do a better job. I feel like they've probably learned from the mistakes of this movie. At the very least, they learned from the mistakes of this movie in recognizing that it needs to be more than one film. Because there is so much to establish. Dune, it doesn't fit easily into the sci-fi mold. And that's part of the reason why it's my favorite book. Because it's a space opera, but it's not familiar. It's not like Star Wars. It's not... It is kind of a hero's journey, but then... It wraps it in all this political intrigue.
It's not World War II in space. There's not an evil empire and dogfights.
Yeah, there's no dogfights. There's no spaceship fights. And most of it takes place on one desert planet. It's much more about the human experience than a lot of sci-fi is directly. A lot of sci-fi is more about humanity and its relationship with its technology. So you do need to do a lot of... setup to lay the groundwork for people to understand that this is not Guardians of the Galaxy. This is not Star Wars. The Bene Gesserit are not Jedi.
I don't think I would have been able to understand any of that without reading the book. And the Bene Gesserit are definitely Jedi in this film.
I hated that because you know like how much I like the Bene Gesserit, and they totally fuck that up. They totally just make them superpowered psychic people, and I hate it. And in fact, of all of the exposition they do barely any for the Bene Gesserit.
That's right. Do they even mention them by name?
They did. They did say Bene Gesserit once or twice.
I think I also want to bring up the fact that you said in some theaters they were handing out booklets so people could figure out what the fuck was going on. That's a sign that you fucked up your movie.
No, the movie's utterly incomprehensible if you haven't read the book. And even if you have read the book, it still disorients you from time to time.
Or when you see the amazing special effects. Ah, the shield effects where a fucking transparent block appears around them.
Well, transparent is actually a generous term for it because it's fairly
right,
opaque.
You're right.
It looks just like two rectangles bashing into each other.
And their voice
hideous.
Is distorted. And speaking of the voice, do you want to talk about the Bene Gesserit voice real quick, Ben?
Yeah, so in the book, well, I think I actually want to talk about the entire aesthetic of the
That's
film.
That's fine. Let's do that.
In addition to the really questionable structure and all the explaining and exposition, the film has this David Lynchian aesthetic that some of his choices are good, some of his choices are weird, but the whole film looks very surrealist. There's a lot of body horror elements. it's supposed to take, it's taking on that like dreamlike psychedelic quality that a lot of David Lynch's stuff has, and it also has that kind of like, I almost want to say, no, maybe like a Hellraiser type aesthetic. It's not a horror movie, but his,
I definitely cringed a lot at some of the imagery. I think I remarked that I wasn't old enough for this movie.
Yeah, I mean, his aesthetic choices are grotesque. Like
a guy rips out a tongue and just starts eating it. Another time you just go straight into a woman's womb. It's like, can you at least give me some warning what you're about to do? The Baron is introduced with like needles getting stabbed into his face.
The Harkonnen stuff is legit body horror. Like the Harkonnens, every scene with the Harkonnens would not be out of place in a Hellraiser, like Clive Barker setting. And that's, so going back to what you said about The Voice, the reason I mention all this together is because David Lynch, ordinarily I like cheesy movies and I like schlock and I like people that just go for it and do whatever pops into their mind, like just chase the vision, make it as over the top as possible. But when it comes to Dune, I won't say I don't enjoy the movie. I do watch it mostly to laugh at it, but I have a good time watching it. So he did achieve something there. But so much of the point of Dune is subtlety. So the Bene Gesserit's voice in particular in the book is described as the Bene Gesserit having total control over the tone, pitch, and, you know, timbre of their voice. And that they can structure their voice in such a way as to be almost hypnotic. Like, it entices you. It gets into your mind. It's a frequency that you can't resist.
And in the movie,
it's just this demon double-tracked, bass-upped distortion that sounds like somebody's casting a fucking dark magic spell on you.
It's fucking Exorcist or something.
Yeah, no, well, that's what I mean. Like, this movie has so many horror elements. And ordinarily, I like that, and I don't even mean to... David Lynch was a weird choice for this project. Like, I don't even really dislike David Lynch, because I do like many of these elements in other settings. But Dune deserved better, I guess. And I shouldn't even say better. It deserved somebody to take its themes seriously in a way that I don't think David Lynch did. Or if he did take them seriously, he doesn't understand them. What did you think about the aesthetic? Like, did you think his visual choices...
I loved when the guys with weird giant like see-through helmets and trash bag armor, when they attacked those guys in traditional military uniforms using wrestling moves and guns that didn't fire anything. I thought that was great. I don't know what you're talking about, Ben. I'm pretty sure that the moral of the story is be God, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and that was the thing. We criticized Dune
for being long and plotting, and it could have easily cut a bunch of shit. And this movie carries in that same tradition by having like an hour and a half at the beginning you could just cut.
I wrote a blog post about whether or not I thought Paul was a white savior stereotype. And I'm not going to get into that here, but the main gist of it was like, yeah, Paul, token hero's journey. He's a typically European coded guy who goes into a exotic or Arabic coded culture and becomes their leader. And yeah, it's a story we've heard.
That is where our friend David Lynch turns it all on its head, Ben. He defies your expectations because a white coded man comes into a white coded civilization.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say the opposite. He leans all the way into it, but...
And then, he does become God at the end.
A white-coated man becomes God of a white-washed, Arabic-coated civilization. No, the point is not about whiteness. I'm not, I don't want to talk about that right now. My point is, the thing I talked about in the blog post, among other things, is that Frank Herbert's Dune book, if you've only read the first book, it is easy to think that he was just going for a straight-up hero's journey. Paul's a great guy. He wins in the end. In Dune Messiah, Frank Herbert turns all that on its head. And I argued that there are indications in the first Dune novel that this was always his intention, that he was trying to set Paul up as kind of a darker figure. And maybe Frank Herbert was trying to talk about the problems of letting your society fall under the leadership of a hero and hero worship in general, and the problems with heroes of all kinds, not just the white savior kind. Like, Frank Herbert, I think, was trying to deconstruct the idea of a savior, whereas this movie totally missed the boat on that, leans all the way into it. Paul is not only a literal savior, he's a literal god with magic.
Yeah, he's got the magic to make it rain. Yeah!
The end, where he calls the rains down on Arrakis, and there's shots of an ocean as if Arrakis is flooding.
Was that what I was supposed to get out of the shots of the ocean?
Boy, I have no idea, man. Well, it's like you were saying, you said a million times, like, what is that supposed to mean? What am I supposed to get out of this? What is
your
shot?
Facial reaction conveying? Sting? Sting, you gotta tell me. I know you listen to our podcast. What was the facial reaction that you're going for when you were just standing in your space underwear making weird eyes at the Baron? What was that?
Yeah. So, having never watched the movie, is it what you thought it would be?
I thought it was going to be like almost like The Room, where it's just everything is wrong about it. And while I can say, I guess, that everything is wrong about it, it's also, like, boring. Like that's why when I got to, like, the 90-minute mark, I was like, oh, they got here pretty quick. But they didn't. It's just nothing happened in the last 90 minutes, and I stopped being able to track time. It's like how I, when we were actually reading the book, I said that maybe you're not remembering some of the bad parts, and your brain is just picking out all those good parts and compressing them together. That's what this movie is, except there were no good parts to compress together. So it's just like, oh, it really has been 90 fucking minutes.
I talked about the movie a lot during our podcast. So did I describe it accurately, or were you not prepared for what you saw?
I don't think I could have ever been prepared for that. I mean, even just the fact that Patrick Stewart was there, like, I knew that you mentioned that he was there, and I knew that I saw on the Wikipedia that he was there, but he kept bringing me out of the movie. He was straight out of Star Trek. Why was he there? He served even less purpose in this movie, somehow, than he did.
I don't think Patrick Stewart wasn't, like, a known entity back then.
Yeah,
it's not like
I didn't think he was. Or else he would not have done this movie.
Yeah. I think casting him was a mistake, but there was so much stuff that was, like, weird, or, like, I don't know.
Weird, what, like, the weirding module? The power source of all of the Atreides' power?
I've never been able to figure that out. So in the book, the impetus for the Emperor to take down the Atreides is that the Atreides are building a fighting force that can rival his Sardaukar. And Leto Atreides is a charismatic guy who has a lot of influence in the Lanzrad, and the Emperor is starting to sense that, okay, this guy's getting a little too popular, he's getting a little too powerful, time for me to take him out. So he gets up with the Harkonnens and he decides to do that. In this movie, the Emperor needs to kill the Atreides because the Atreides have developed a sound weapon technology that gives them too much of an advantage. And he's got to kill all
even
of them.
Even though they never really use the shields ever in the movie. No. They use it once for that fight and then never again.
See, my thought is that from a screenwriting perspective, they maybe thought that the Emperor's motivation was too weak. I could see if they thought the Emperor's motivation was too weak, because it kind of is, until you understand the world of Dune is just cutthroat
he's
politics.
He's building political power, he's forging alliances, and he's gaining in strength, and so we gotta stop him now before he can't be stopped. That's a real world motivation.
Yeah, it wasn't super dramatic, it was just practical. And so I guess they wanted to make it more dramatic or visually
obvious.
Well,
yeah, I mean, the Emperor actually didn't even want to do it in the book, but he knew that he had to.
Yeah. So they spent a lot of effort, like trying to fix a problem I don't think was there, and then instead just, like, it seems like a lot of effort was put into the first half of the movie. And then almost no effort was put into the last half of the movie, which is where all the stuff happens.
They sprint through all the important stuff happening, but they take their time with, like, part one and the lead up to when they actually meet the Fremen in the desert. All that stuff is slow paced, and then they meet the Fremen and they're like, hey, you're going to be part of my tribe, and we'll take care of you. Also, you're our leader now. Also, train these warriors in your way so that we can win. All right, and you did that, and now it's 2 years later.
Well, and that's that really does just double down on the problem I have with them chucking all the darkness and all the themes of heroes not being a good thing, is you spend all this effort retooling the Emperor's motivations for attacking the Atreides, and you take a problem that was already existing in the book of the Fremen having weak motivations for accepting Paul, and you just make it 10 times worse by taking even those weak motivations and throwing them out the window. Because they barely even deal with the Fremen prophecy.
At the end of the movie, they're like, hey, there's this Fremen prophecy that says Paul is like God now. All right, all hail him. Roll credits.
Well, and that, like, I don't know if they were afraid to tackle the religious themes, but the religion is like, the Empire is there in the story to explore politics, and the Fremen are there to explore religion and the intersection of religion and politics.
I actually didn't get really anything from the Fremen, because they met them and then they were just off to the fucking races.
Yeah. What'd you think of Toto?
You know, it didn't bother me as much as it bothered you, but
it bothered me a lot. That soundtrack fucking sucks.
You know, the end credits should have been Africa. Because the raid's coming down.
Oh my god.
They missed an opportunity.
It should have been Arrakisa.
Oh, God.
There were things I did like. They did a really good job with the worms. I liked all those effects. I didn't like the green screen effects.
Hey, I'll give him that, because I was impressed that first time that worm came out. It was like, oh, yeah, you can actually get the scale of these fucking things. They're gigantic.
The worms were as I imagined them. The still suits were mostly as I imagined them. And the stillsuit design seems pretty consistent from this movie to the new movie. What did you think of the... I can't tell if this is a problem of me watching it on, like, a modern HD screen, or if other audiences would have noticed that, but the very inconsistent, like, very inconsistent blue eye effect.
Yeah, it was bad. It was just bad.
They don't bother to apply it at all in the wide shots.
Because that takes a lot of work. They'll apply it in the close-ups. That's also not how I imagine the blue eyes.
No, like glowing, terrible blue filters. And the fact that they glow means you would see them in the wide shots or when somebody's eyes are half
that's,
closed.
Like, that's too difficult, though. That's a lot of extra special effects stuff.
Yeah, honestly, I think they ran out of money. I don't know the story. I'm sure you could find out, but...
That's a lot more effort than I'm willing to put in on this movie.
That was my thing. Like, it's just not that interesting. It's not that good. It totally...
I don't know how you watched this three times. That's impressive to me. I don't think I'm ever going to watch this fucking movie again.
I do think it's bad to the point of being good. I will say, though, that the second time I watched it required two sessions. We did not watch the whole movie in one sitting.
I will say, though, the best part of the movie, which is the best part by far, is they're having this dramatic action fight that wasn't even in the book. It was just skipped over. And the Baron gets killed, and his suspensors activate, and he floats away into a sandworm's mouth. I could watch that several times.
If you take any detail that was described in the book and you turn it up to 11, throw any sense of subtlety or realism out the window, that's this movie. Like, the Baron has suspensors that help him walk because he's very heavy. So he's described as having, like, being a gigantic man with the grace of a ballerina. Because he's not supporting his own weight. So in this one, he flies.
And Thufir has an entire bottom lip just made of herpes?
Yeah, because his lips were stained by the stimulant that the Mentats take. I don't have a lot more to say, because we did talk about it a lot on the podcast, but do you have any bits you want to add? Because honestly, I said a lot of my observations in the podcast when we first talked about it.
No, I think we pretty well covered it. It just sprints right at the end, and they don't really know how to adapt this thing. They kept a whole bunch of worthless characters who don't really have any impact on the plot, which is a problem with the book itself. But they keep all that in, and they don't spend enough time on the stuff at the end that is the more important bits. Instead, they're like, we gotta know about Duncan Idaho before he gets a slow-moving bullet to the brain, question mark? We gotta know. We gotta know about Yue and Jessica and their weird little talk, and like, it's bad. It's really bad. I don't think it's bad to the point of being good, but I can see why you might think that. I just think it's...
If it were an hour shorter, it would be bad to the point of being good.
Okay. I can accept that. If they cut out all the extra fluff...
It is a big time commitment, and we're not really selling you on our riff tracks that we're going to be putting a lot of work into, so...
Yeah, you're right. Everyone go watch the movie one time, but make sure our riff track's playing over it.
All right. Take us out, Nate.
All right. Well, next month, we are going to be reading and discussing Harun and the Sea of Stories by Salman Rushdie. That's next week. And if you haven't read it yet to read along with us, it's actually a pretty short and sweet read, so you can get started now and be ready for next week. And you want to add all the plugs for Twitter and...
Yeah, check us out on WAB Pod. That's the best place to stay up for our latest episode releases. And I will definitely be posting there when the riff track is available. You can check out our additional show notes and commentary at blog.wordsaboutbooks.ninja. You can check out our own writing at poorlywritten.ninja. You can also join our Goodreads group. It's Words About Books Podcast. Go to the Groups tab, search for our name, and you will find us. I'd also like to remind you to check out, if you're into video games, the Words About Games Podcast. They are our sister podcast, and they do video game reviews for the modern adult.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. bless the rains down in Arasica. No, that was awful.